The following Dominican University of California production has been brought to you by radio.dominican.edu.
Welcome to the Institute for Leadership Studies lecture series. Today we'll be hosting Gloria Steinem, and she'll be presenting on her book, My Life on the Road. The presentation starts at 1 p.m., so join us here at Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu.
We're going to get underway with Gloria in just about 5 minutes. I just wanted to let you know a few things about the afternoon. It is so fabulous to see so many young people in this hall. I love you students. Thank you for coming out. So, here's that moment where you make that decision to put away all your devices, wriggle around in your purses and backpacks, turn them off, because the hour belongs to Gloria. She will be answering questions directly from the audience, so be formulating and framing succinct questions to ask her. This is your time to find things out from Gloria about her astounding life. So we're gonna get underway in just a matter of minutes, so sit tight, and we'll be back with you shortly.
Good afternoon. It's wonderful to be here with all of you. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm Mary Marcy. I'm the president of Dominican University of California. And today I am a very proud president because I get the privilege of welcoming back to Dominican. Some of you may remember that Gloria Steinem was in Dominican in 1995. So we're welcoming back to Dominican Gloria Steinem. I will do a very brief introduction because I think most of us know Gloria Steinem, and what we really want is to hear from her. So I will just say a couple of quick things to get us started. What many of you probably know is that today's program is part of Dominican's Leadership Lecture Series, highlighting inspired acts of leadership across academic disciplines, which is part of our Institute for Leadership Studies. What you may not know is that the Leadership Lecture Series is now celebrating its 11th year in partnership with Marin's own Book Passage. So thanks to Book Passage for partnering with Dominican in this remarkable lecture series. This special event ties into Dominican's inaugural university-wide community engagement theme of democracy and equity, and into our work engaging students with the upcoming presidential election cycle. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, and in the spirit of feminism and of Gloria Steinem, we have multiple sponsors who have collaborated on this event. Our lead sponsor, in the fifth year as the lead sponsor of the lecture series, is Private Ocean, Personal Powerful Wealth Management. The CEO, Richard Stone, and part of his team are here. So thank you to Private Ocean. Here's Richard. We're also sponsored today by two Marin women's organizations, both of whom consistently offer sponsorship support so that Dominican and its partners can offer relevant and exciting educational forums like this one. Dominican's Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council is a giving circle of Dominican women and members of the community at large, and they focus on supporting Dominican programming that develops women as philanthropic leaders. So our thanks to the Dominican Women's Leadership and Philanthropy Circle. And finally, the Marin Women's Commission, which returns often to support a leadership lecture that matches its mission and values. It's hard to imagine a lecture more suitable for them to help sponsor. So thank you to the Marin Women's Commission. And my notes now say, introduce Gloria Steinem. How does someone introduce Gloria Steinem? I will tell you what I did this morning as I was thinking about this project, and I thought, if we took all the time to list all of the awards and recognitions, that would be satisfying perhaps to me, but probably not to our speaker, and probably not entirely why you're here. So I'll mention only that among many other awards, she has received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the single highest civilian honor an American can receive. I will also tell you that I've seen a few interviews with Gloria Steinem recently, and the media often refer to her as an icon, and she visibly blanches when they say that. So I thought, well, being an academic, I thought I would look up what the word icon means. And she may blanch, it's hard to argue with this. It says a person or thing regarded as a representative symbol of something. So the definition works, but what's more interesting is that dictionaries always give the definition and then they use it in a sentence. Here's the sentence in which they use the word icon. Think of this as an iron-jawed icon of American manhood. So now I understand why it's not her favorite term. I'll conclude by saying that I believe it's entirely appropriate that Dominican, an institution founded by strong women and one that has honored and nurtured women's voices for generations, is hosting this lecture today. For our students who may not know the whole history, many of you would literally not be here today with access to a college education were it not for feminism and for Gloria Steinem. Many of you would not expect to have jobs in business, academe, industry, or nonprofits were it not for the leadership of Gloria Steinem and people like her. Your right to your own bodies, your opportunities for finding your own calling, your reasonable expectations for equal value and equal pay are due, thanks in large part to our speaker this afternoon. Please join me in welcoming Gloria Steinem.
Thank you so much. We have about an hour together in this room in a combination of people that probably has never happened before in quite the same way and may not ever happen again in quite the same way. Each of us is also a combination of heredity and environment over millennia that could never have happened before again. So what I look forward to most of all is turning this into a talking circle when we can learn from each other. Selfishly, I want to learn from you, okay? And I'm always hoping that as a result of our meetings today, some outrageous act will take place tomorrow that would not otherwise have happened. So I'll read you a little bit just by way of preface, because I bet, how many of you were here in 1995, anybody? One, two, three, seven, about five, six. Okay, all right. So I just thought it'd be fun, since I travel so much, it's kind of like a novel. You know, you get the next chapter of, you know, what you saw before from 1995, and then a little bit more about campuses, and then we can start our organizing meeting. It's 1995, and I am at Dominican College near San Francisco because an outdoor amphitheater on its campus holds 1,000 people. It is about to be the site of a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. No one has uttered a peep of protest. Planned Parenthood clinics have provided health care for so many for so long that it has become one of the most trusted organizations in America. Even some anti-abortion protesters seem to have figured out that demonstrating against clinics only turns public opinion against them, the demonstrators, especially since just 3% of Planned Parenthood services are related to abortion. But this is the calm before the storm. Archbishop John Quinn of San Francisco writes a letter to the college president condemning me as a, quote, leading advocate for virtually unrestricted abortion in the U.S., unquote. Though the college gets not a penny from the Catholic Church, it was founded by Dominican nuns long ago. They are no longer around to speak for themselves, but the archbishop says their legacy is being betrayed. Everything just keeps going, both the accusations and the event. Some contributors do indeed withhold their funds from the college, which is hurtful. But when the trustees hold firm to their support for free speech on campus, new contributions make up for the loss of the old. If anything, the Archbishop has only brought more media coverage of an era of declining church membership, aging priests, shutdowns of a dozen historic churches, the revelations of sexual abuse by priests, and many other troubles that caused him to be summoned to the Vatican for tactical consultation. On the day itself, I'm impressed to see a small protest plane circling over the amphitheater pulling an anti-abortion banner. Someone yells out, "Look, the Right to Lifers have an Air Force." The event goes right on. Even though I know this lonely little plane is a commercial one that can be hired for birthdays, weddings, and advertising, the symbolism of its constant circling makes me sad. Talking later to Dolores Huerta, my friend of 30 years, a lifetime organizer of farm workers in efforts to elect progressive women, I tell her that I can't shake the sadness of this symbolic distance between an airplane representing the church and the real lives of women on the ground. She reminds me of the organizer's mantra, "Roots can exist without flowers, but no flower can exist without roots." Religion may be a flower, but people are its roots. 3 months later, Archbishop John Quinn retires at the age of 62, 9 years ahead of schedule. San Francisco newspapers report that he was thought to be too distant from the people. Thank you. Now, I thought I'd just read you a little bit of why I'm in love with campuses. I am so in love with campuses. How do I love campuses? Let me count the ways. I love the coffee shops and the reading rooms where one can sit and talk or browse forever. I love the buildings with no addresses that only the initiated can possibly find, and the idiosyncratic clothes that would never make it in the outside world. I love the flash parties that start in some odd spot and can't be moved, and the flash seminars that any discussion can turn into. I love the bulletin boards that are an education in themselves, the friendships between people who would never otherwise have met, and the time for inventiveness that produces, say, an exercise bike that powers a computer. Most of all, I love graduations. They are individual and communal, an end and a beginning, more permanent than weddings, more inclusive than religions, and possibly the most moving ceremonies on earth. I'm often asked how many campuses I've visited. The truth is, I have no idea. I've gone to several each month of my lifetime on the road, and I've gone back to many more than once. All I know for sure is that university and college campuses, with some high schools and prep schools added, have been the single largest slice of my traveling pie, and they still are. And just to give you a sense of progress, in my own college life, I got through 4 years as a government major without learning that women were not just given the vote, that the real number of slave rebellions was suppressed because rebelling was contagious, or that the model for the U.S. Constitution was not ancient Greece, but the Iroquois Confederacy. I hope you're learning this now. Then academic courses on Europe far outnumbered those on Africa, even though Africa is the birthplace of us all and is bigger than Europe, China, India, and the United States combined. When I'm on campus now and look at course listings, the relative importance reflected them is much better than it was, but still way off. There has always been this question of what is being taught. As Gerda Lerner, a pioneer of women's history in general, and African-American women's history in particular, summed it up, "We have long known that rape has been a way of terrorizing us and keeping us in subjection. Now we also know that we have participated, although unwittingly, in the rape of our minds." No wonder studies show that women's intellectual self-esteem tends to go down as years of education go up. We have been studying our own absence. I say this as a reminder that campuses not only help create social justice movements, they need social justice movements. Now, campuses look more like the country in terms of race and ethnicity, though we're not there yet, and bias can survive college degrees. I see women outnumbering their male counterparts on some campuses, but degrees are often a way out of the pink-collar ghetto and into a white-collar ghetto. Women still average much less in earnings over a lifetime than men do and have to pay back the same college debt. Actually, since then, I've learned that women earn an average of $1 million less over a lifetime and have to pay back the same college debt. No wonder young women are very pissed. I see campuses representing more age diversity. More than a third of college students are over 25, and this age group is growing faster than students of conventional age, a change that was pioneered by veterans and the GI Bill of Rights, then by older women returning to campus. I have watched a 30-year-old pregnant woman arguing about the healthcare system with an 18-year-old male student, and I have thought, this has to be good for education. So that's just a passage as a kind of introductory thought to our discussion. But I hope that you feel free to use this magical time we have right now to say anything you would like to say to this community. It doesn't have to relate to me at all. To ask me any questions, or announce any upcoming troublemaking meetings you this group should know about, and generally to use this kind of magical space and time that we have together right now. I'm so grateful to you for taking time out of your lives, and I hope from the bottom of my heart that just maybe things will be a little different, a little better tomorrow, the next day, and the next, because we were together today. Thank you. So,
we have a question over here.
I'm a little blinded by the sunlight here. Okay.
I'm very sorry to start the questions by even appearing to contradict you, but the Dominican sisters are not gone. I wonder if the Dominican sisters continue here to be a bridge between that plane in the sky and those lives on the ground.
Well, good.
To fight that battle.
That
and
sounds
I wondered
good to me.
If there are any Dominican sisters here who would like to stand and say hello.
All right, well, that's good news, and it will appear in the next. This was used as a defense, I think, against the taking instructions at that time from the church, who was in control of this campus and who wasn't. But I will make clear that the Dominican sisters are here, and our sisters.
Hi, Gloria. I'm actually a little starstruck right now, to be honest. I have a question for you. I'm going to start with a personal anecdote. I am a freshman communications major with an emphasis in sports media. I intend to pursue a degree and a career in sports journalism, which I understand is a heavily male-dominated field. And I, too, have experienced personal sexism growing up, being a sports fan, and being knowledgeable about sports in general. I know that I'm at a disadvantage because apparently women can't know sports. They absolutely can. So, and you started as a journalist for the New York Times. What advice do you have for young women going into sports journalism or journalism in general to kind of face the adversity that they have just because of their gender?
You know, this has been a struggle that, as you know, that has been going on for at least 40 years. At first, women were not allowed in locker rooms at all to have interview privileges. There were no women being hired to cover sports. But I think that as both women have covered more men's sports and more women have been part of the sports world, we have come to see profound changes. I think what we haven't quite realized, and what we need wonderful sports journalists like you to tell us, is how important sports are for women. You know, in poor cultures, fat women are valued because it's a sign of prosperity, right? In rich cultures, thin women are valued because it's a sign of, you know, upper class or whatever. But in all those, in all male dominant cultures, which both of those are, weakness is valued in women. So for women to become strong, for our bodies to become strong, is a seriously radical act. You know, for us to realize that our bodies are not just ornaments, they are instruments, and what they do is a very radical act. And I'm so glad that you're going to be there to emphasize this and to report on it, which I think we haven't quite absorbed yet. I also think that the dangerousness of some sports, I'm thinking of football and all the brain injuries that we are only now learning about, but have been a subject of alarm and complaint, mainly, it seems, you know, I'm sure the fathers were there somewhere, but it's the mothers who organized about about the brain injury to their sons. And I've just been talking to a friend of mine who is a neurologist and who has been asked by the NBA to assess various brain injuries, and she says that it breaks her heart. It breaks her heart, you know, to see grown men coming in to see her and behaving, you know, like children almost, you know, because they have suffered so much brain injury. So I think that as a nexus of gender, you know, in different ways, the sports field hasn't really been covered as seriously as it should be, including, for instance, the habit of some campuses of giving scholarships to young men, usually for football, but for basketball and other sports too, and then not giving them an education. You know, using them to make money for the jockocracy, as I think of it, as Flo Kennedy always called it, but not giving them an education. Ms. Magazine once, not so long ago, published an article about one such case in a southern university in which a female professor on campus exposed the lack of education being given to young men who had been recruited to play football. As a response to that, there was a kind of false scandal generated about how she had had some sexual attention from or affair with a football player. It ended up in a court case, and the reason the court case was won was because the football player, who had supposedly written a sexual letter to the professor proving their sexual relationship, was asked in court to read the letter and could not. I mean, you cannot make this up. You know, it is, that's an extreme form of the scandal, but it is present. It is present. So sports is a kind of microcosm of progress and regress and gender craziness, and, you know, and I'm so glad that we're going to have you as a journalist. This is, you know, it could not be a richer field and a field more in need of good journalism. So, thank you.
I have another question over here.
Hi, Gloria. If this is what 81 is like, sign me up.
I tell everybody on the street that I'm 81 because I can't believe it myself.
I know. So
I'm trying to convince myself, because to think you're immortal causes you to plan poorly.
Yeah. Well, actually, right in alignment with that, I originally met you in New York at the National Council for Research on Women event that was honoring you. And I said to you, do you ever think about retiring? And you said, how can I retire? I don't have a job. But all I want from you today, please, is to tell people why supporting and voting for Hillary is a vote of conscience.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not here to tell anybody how to vote, but I'll tell you why I'm voting. You know, I mean, right. First of all, I think maybe we should make a button that says Snow White and the 17 Dwarfs. You know, there's... Shocking, isn't it? I mean, I as a New Yorker, I am so apologetic for Donald Trump. I really... but, you know, I have to say also that as a Democrat, I apologize to all of my real Republican friends, because what happened historically is that Democrats who became upset with the Democratic Party for being too inclusive after the Civil Rights Act, Jesse Helms was emblematic of this, right? It was a Democrat who went over and joined the Republican Party. And gradually, right-wing, often religious fundamentalists, different various groups that had been part of the Democratic Party went over and took over the Republican Party. So now it does not resemble the majority views of Republicans anymore. And it nominates people who don't seem able to be likely to win the general election. I hope and pray there are Republicans here who are willing to take back this great American party, which used to be the first to support equality of all kinds, both sex and race. It's very, very dangerous, you know, that is controlled by, right now, at least the nominating process, is controlled by extremists. Both Hillary Clinton and Obama were running, there was a full year when they were both running, and people would say to me, are you supporting Obama or Hillary Clinton? And I would say, yes. Because they were and are the same on the issues. You know, she is a civil rights advocate, he is a feminist. And in the end, I supported Hillary Clinton because of her greater experience, specifically with the ultra-right wing. I think he was just, not because he's not smarter than all of us, but because of his experience, he didn't understand, he was kept trying to reach out to the right wing in Washington. I mean, he has such good peacemaking instincts, and he spent the first 2 years doing that with no success, really, because he didn't understand who they were. And I thought Hillary, we could have had 8 years of Hillary first and then 8 years of Obama. But it turned out to be the other way. Now I think she is simply the most experienced candidate. I'm glad that Bernie Sanders is there. He's bringing up economic issues that are terribly important. He just introduced legislation, or perhaps it's not his, but anyway, in Congress there's a piece of legislation that would make it against the law for a profit-making enterprise to own a prison or to run a prison, which would be so important. I mean, it's so outrageous that Wackenhut and all, you know, part of the reason we have a huge prison industrial complex, and please read Brian Stevenson's Just Mercy, a wonderful, wonderful book, is because it's profitable. And because we don't care about, we don't pay attention, California's better, New York's better, but we don't pay the same attention to our state legislatures that we pay to Washington. So I think, you know, we have this agenda before us, and I'm glad everybody's discussing it, but Vermont doesn't have a foreign policy, you know, and and Hillary Clinton has had long experience in foreign policy. It just seems to me totally clear that she is by far the most qualified, experienced, principled candidate we could possibly have. And I'll tell you one more reason. You know, at this moment, we've discovered that there is so much violence against women worldwide, against females worldwide, whether that is the bias that has produced a son surplus and a daughter deficit in so much of Asia and other parts of the world, or whether it is child marriage that is still a common practice throughout dozens of countries, or female genital mutilation in the millions, or domestic violence here. We have to understand that we are part of this, you know, that actually if you added up all the women who have been murdered by their husbands and boyfriends since 9/11, and then added up all the Americans killed in 9/11, two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, more women have been killed by domestic terrorism than Americans have lost their life to foreign terrorism. So this has happened to such a degree that now, for the first time, there are fewer females on spaceship Earth than males. I don't know that that's happened before. There's a wonderful book called Sex and World Peace, which explains all this, documents all this, and is readable. And you know, so far, Hillary is the only person in national public life who has made this who understands that violence against women, against females, is the determiner, the normalizer of all other violence. So it has to be a element in our foreign policy. She and only she has made that clear. And as sex and world peace also makes clear, that violence against females, which just comes about from patriarchies trying to control reproduction and therefore controlling women and saying sex is only okay if it ends in reproduction and, you know, everything we know, that the biggest indicator of violence inside a country, in the street, wherever, or whether or not that country will be willing to use military violence against another country, is actually not poverty, not access to natural resources, not religion, and not even degree of democracy. It's violence against females. Not because female life is any more important than male life, but because that is the most intimate form of violence or control, dominant, passive kind of thinking. People are born, one group is born to be controlled by the other, which is utter bullshit. It's totally not true, right? That is where it gets normalized, and we're way more likely to accept the idea that one race dominates the other, one caste in India dominates the other, one class dominates the other. So, I feel it's very clear to me that right now she is the only person who has made that tried to make it part of foreign policy to the best that she could, because if she was not in control of foreign policy, obviously the White House was in control up to now, and is pledged to do so in the future. And that's, I think that's important to all of us.
Up here on the balcony.
Oh.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Before I came here, I promised my grandmother, who read Mrs. Magazine for many, many decades, that I would ask you a question. And as a history student, I have to ask if you can comment on why women's history, particularly in the 20th century, is so important, and explain what perspective this provides for other countries' women's movements.
You know, the greatest statement on this I've ever seen is in the American Indian Museum in Washington. Have you ever gone to this? It's a wonderful museum. And there's a lecture right at the beginning on screen. And the historian is saying there are two things, history and the past, and they are not the same. I mean, history is profoundly political. We learn more about Europe than about, you know, which is like a postage stamp compared to the rest of the world. We learn more about white folks than people of color. We learn more about, you know, I don't have to tell you that. So it is, if we don't see ourselves in history, we think we can't be part of it. We can't act. And also we're not being told what actually happened. What outrages me most is just personally because I'm discovering it, so, you know, it's not a value judgment, but as you'll see in the book, from wandering around the country for 40 years, I began to understand that I knew nothing about this country before Columbus showed up, and that there were enormous, sophisticated, important cultures that have caused a friend of mine to write a book called Everything We Want Once Was Here. But we don't know it, right? So on all of those grounds, to rule women of all races somehow only important when they give birth to male leaders and not as instruments of history, is just wrong. It's just plain wrong. And on top of that, in addition to being inaccurate, it also makes people who are women who of all races, colors, who are reading this think they can't make history because we don't see ourselves. So it's just 100% crucial. And I'm very grateful, say, to Gerda Lerner, who was a pioneer of women's history, especially African-American women's history, to all the people who have done this research and got it out there.
Experience here. I was president of Planned Parenthood at the time, and it only happened because you initiated, you offered to come do something for Planned Parenthood, as you do in so many communities. And I think it's an important piece of your work that as you go out and do your book tour or you give of yourself and to allow other important organizations to fundraise. So thank you for that. The question really relates to the Cecile Richards hearings. The connection you're making relative to what's essentially misogyny, and where it goes for the autonomy of women, not only of their body, but their future, and what you see happening in the next decade or two. And thank you.
Well, we must remember that reproductive freedom, like freedom of speech, all the other basic human rights, it's basic because it influences so many other things. I mean, whether a woman can control when and whether to have children is the single biggest determinant of whether she is educated or not, whether she can work outside the home or not, whether she is healthy or not, and how long she lives. So, you know, the power, I think sometimes we, both women and men, need a new principle called bodily integrity or something like that. You know, the power of the government stops at our skins. Planned Parenthood is the most trusted, it is actually the most trusted organization in the United States because it has been providing services to at least a third of the country that might not have been available otherwise, and it has always stood for reproductive freedom. So, you know, I think it's just kind of basic, you know, what could be more basic? And it has also protected men against involuntary sterilization and, you know, all kinds of infringement against reproductive freedom.
Hi. So my question has two parts.
Where are you, in the back here?
Yes.
I can't quite see.
My question has two parts. The first part is, you know, I was born in 1968, and I grew up hearing about feminism, and it's always couched in the terms of equal pay for women for the most part. And what I see is that the young women of today are giving away their bodies thinking that, hey, I'm equal to a man. But the truth is that as women, we respond to, you know, having intercourse with a man a little bit differently. And I don't see that these young girls who don't really even know who they are yet, or these women are, you know, being made happier by this. If anything, they're being taken advantage of in certain ways. And I'm wondering what you see as, like, maybe the way to address this form of inequality for women. And the second part is that, well, I forgot, so we'll just go with that.
That's so nice of you to say that, because I can hardly remember how I like my eggs these days, so I'm you know, I'm not, I think we have to look at each situation and ask and support each other. The question is it the free will of the young woman, or does she feel pressured into doing what she doesn't want to do? I worry a little bit that some of us who are older and therefore lived in an era in which dressing a certain way or revealing your body in a certain way was blameworthy, you know. Although even I remember walking around in miniskirts with the terrible sexual buttons, you know, that we all wore. That's what were they all? I can't remember. Anyway, I'm sure I was alarming my older women friends too. But I think that because we see behavior that wasn't okay for us, we may not understand that it is self-willed for the women involved, and it is body pride, and it is okay. You know. So, you know, the question really is this what you want, and do you have the power to pursue what you want as opposed to feeling obligated? I mean, when I speak in high schools, for instance, you know, when we're talking about blowjobs, sometimes I say, well, do you get oral sex? And they're embarrassed. You know, the same women, the same young women who feel they have to provide blowjobs are embarrassed by the whole idea that they have a clitoris, which happens to be the only human organ completely and utterly devoted to pleasure. With nothing. Can you imagine what men would do with that if they... So, you know, I don't know that I would necessarily feel okay about generalizing and saying that all females have a different response to sexuality than all males. I think we have to ask that question of ourselves and support each other in the answer, so that we are not being made to use our bodies in a way that we don't, that isn't our own will and judgment and pleasure. And, you know, it is, I have to say, it is crucial. It is crucial because body invasion is way more traumatic than even getting beaten up on the outside. It has really lasting consequences. Who understands this completely are men in prison. You know, I get lots of mail from men in prison. And they can't write what they want necessarily because they're censored. And so only when I saw men who had written me who were now out of prison did they tell me that the reason they were just writing for a picture, an autograph, or something like that is because they related to the women's movement, because in the absence of women, they had been treated like women sexually. So, you know, I agree with you that we need to think seriously about the trauma of body invasion. And at the other end, the joy and the pleasure and the right to bodily autonomy and making our own decisions. So we're going to end on sex, are we? Okay.
So I love the recent New Yorker article where you describe an early trip to India and learn what you called, you referred to it here, the ancient and modern magic of talking circles. And it remains the most, I think, fundamental and grounding force of feminism. And it reminded me of the feminist theologian Nell Morton, who describes the same idea in the phrase, hearing each other in speech. So I wonder, you know, beyond this wonderful gathering, how can a campus like Dominican support different ways, large and small, of hearing each other in the speech more and continuing this incredible tradition of talking circles?
That's a great place to end. Thank you so much, because that's a continuance, right? Well, first of all, it isn't just women who need it. Women and men, human beings need talking circles. We've been sitting around campfires for at least 100,000 years, telling stories. It's why our brains are organized on narrative. If you tell somebody a fact or a statistic, that person will invent a narrative as to why it's true. Right? So it's the way our thoughts are organized. And the problem is that some people have not been part of the general campfire, and so now need our own campfires to catch up. And that may be, for any reason of caste in India or, you know, gender, all the reasons we already know. But we are communal creatures. We definitely need to be able to tell our stories, to understand that we may be experiencing something that we think only we are experiencing, and then we hear six other people say it, and we think, I'm not alone, you know? And if that's true, probably the problem is political, if different, unique people are experiencing it, and if we get together, we can do something about it. It's the way we understand that we are not crazy, the system is crazy. This is deep, you know? So I think that campuses like this are great, great places to begin the support and the tradition and the organic importance of having talking circles in your life. Women and men together, students together, professors together, you know, however it is that it makes sense. You could have one whole bulletin board. Do you still have bulletin boards, or it's all online? Anyway, describing what the kind of circle you would like to have at this moment. You may have different subjects at different times. You know, new parents tend to form circles together to discover, you know, that they're not experiencing this major revolution all by themselves. Whatever it is, I hope that somewhere in our lives we all have a group of people, at least, hopefully once a week, at least once a month, that we can tell the truth to, that we feel helped by sharing experience, that we look forward to. You know, you can always tell a good meeting from a bad meeting in the following way. A bad meeting, you say, oh God, I have to go to another meeting. A good meeting, you say, oh, good, you know. But we do absolutely need to make these campfires and to sit around them and talk to each other. It's the way we stay sane, it's the way we make change, it's the way we discover what's possible. And, you know, however this happens on this campus, around subject matter, experience, whatever it is, I hope that it blossoms. I bet it's already here in a lot of your lives, right? I meet women and men around the country who have been sustained by such small groups of people for 20 years, 30 years. I think that maybe witches had the right idea, you know, because they had 13 people in a coven, and 13, that's kind of the maximum number that everybody can speak, everybody can listen, and if you vote, you don't get tied. So they, you know, they can't be too huge because you all want to be able to participate, but they're absolutely crucial. They are our campfires. Thank you.
I love finishing with the talking circle, and I think Gloria Steinem carries a campfire with her. I think you create that circle wherever you go. So our thanks to Gloria Steinem for being here, and I'd like to introduce Elaine Petrocelli, who will describe to you how we will get your book signed. So, Elaine?
Thank you, Mary. And thanks to all of you for being part of our really huge circle. So that there's time for all of us to get our book signed, we are not going to personalize, and we're only going to sign Life on the Road. So I know you may have some old treasures you'd love to get signed, but we can't do it today. This was such an amazing event, and I know that it's going to go out in circles throughout the community. Thank you so much.
We just had the fabulous honor to listen to Gloria Steinem presenting for the Institute for Leadership Studies here at Dominican University of California. Thank you for listening to the live broadcast here on Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu.